So let's talk about a thumbnail sketch of this film, Clandestine Childhood.
This is Dr. St. Paul from Global Languages and Theater Arts. We could say that the film steps really into the heart of a situation that took place in the 70s and 80s in Argentina. We follow a family of basically guerrilleros, people who had fled the country when the junta took office and started persecuting them because they were basically former progressives. I mean, they were progressive. They were Peronistas, or let's see, the progressive version of Peronistas. They had fled and lived in Cuba, and we find them coming back to the country to continue their fight, as I say. So they come with the intention of being subversives, and they take their children with them. And so this is the story, is how they actually continue their fight as underground Montoneros in this country and with their children. And this whole story is narrated from the point of view of their 11-year-old son.
Now, you used a term, Peronista. Let's unpack that. What is a Peronista?
Juan Perón was a populist leader within Argentina. He had been exiled prior to when this movie takes place to Spain. And after his 18-year exile, he came back to the country. And his party was, in his movement, was sort of a mass catch-all type party. So it filled everyone within the ideological spectrum. But when he was coming back, it was starting to fragment. So there were left-wing groups and right-wing that were more of the fascist type perspective within the Peronist movement. And once he had come back, he was then became president. His wife, Isabel, was then vice president. After he dies, his wife takes over, but then quickly the military, by 1975, was starting what became known as the Dirty War, where they were fighting against some of the left-wing groups, in particular the one that's discussed in this movie, that had wanted to start a guerrilla-type movement, insurgency within the country. But by the end of this Dirty War, and when the Argentine government eventually moves away from this military junta and becomes a democracy by 1983, it was really anybody that opposed this repressive government that was targeted. So there were some subversive groups, guerrilla groups fighting in the country, but the vast majority of those that were later targeted were anybody that spoke out against the government and its regime and its repressive behaviors.
So this sounds like politically certainly a turbulent time. Culturally, though, what's happening in Argentina during this period?
Culturally, life went on. Life was just for us keep going. So there were bombs exploding in a corner. That happened to me an hour before. I walked through a corner an hour before a bomb went off. And so this was a terrorist attack in an area. But and I think going back to the movie, because that's what the director is doing by presenting the perspective of a child, that although he was living this double life, being the child of a military, of a Montonero family, of a revolutionary family, having to have a double identity, even changing his name, his life went still on. He went to school. He has his first crush, falling in love with a little classmate. They celebrate birthdays with the family. They went to see grandma. So that is the focus of the film, to show the perspective of what was life like for a child. The child was not conscious of fully grasping what was going on politically. And just, for example, his birth name was Juan, which is a reference to the political ideology of the parents having been Peronist, because it refers to Juan Perón. When they come back to Argentina in 79 to continue this fight, they are going to name the child Ernesto, which is a clear reference to Che Guevara, whose name was Ernesto. So there we see the ideology of the other ideology that the parents have. Now, the child knows he has these two names, but he is not fully grasping what these two names mean. And I think maybe by presenting this perspective, the director is also kind of putting the audience in that place, not being fully aware of all the implications that those names mean, unless you are familiar with the history. And so then you can pull these two things together.
I noticed that there is an animation component.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that animation is used to kind of mark that delineation.
Well, I think I really enjoyed that he decided to portray a couple of very violent moments through the graphic strip instead of showing the real life violence. You still can get how violent it was, but in a different way. And aesthetically, I thought it was a very good choice from the director's part.
It's not jarring. I mean, because sometimes that juxtaposition between the typical, and I'm presuming a lot here, but cinematic realism and then dropping animation in it can throw things off. I mean, animation can work very well in depictions of violence. We saw that with Waltzim Bashir, an Israeli film, which is entirely animated. But something like this, I'm getting the feeling that you believe that this animation is woven in very deftly.
Yes. Well, because in a way, it's like unbelievable. This was happening. So it's kind of unbelievable. So that's because it kind of out of the blue, you see this graphic insert there.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe in a way it's kind of just...
It's supposed to jar you, in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
And it's suggestive, if I may add that, in the sense that the point, and I think Benjamin Avila, the director, states it, the point is not to do a political treatise. He goes to the human element. And he acknowledges his influence from European directors like Emir Kusturica, the Serbian director of Sweet 16, or Ken Loach. We showed that Angel's Share, or even the famous Polish director Kieslowski, with the three color, they are all showing aspects of culture, but showing it from a human element with humor. I can quote, I just read a quote from Kieslowski, who said that if culture can do something for the world, it really is to focus on things that, commonalities, same joy, same pain, that people can relate to anywhere.
Hmm.
And he states that there are many things that divide people. The nationalism is one, religion is another, politics, history, where they're all different. But really, the sentiment is the same. And so by angling his movie through the eyes of a child who doesn't grasp everything, but who gets an idea, and that his parents don't want him to tell the truth, that he has to live a double identity, shows that the pain that he actually goes through. I mean, he grows too fast, too quickly. He luckily is not killed, because one of the things that the junta wasn't doing was killing children. Instead, they killed the parents. Actually, they disappeared. They called it desaparecidos, and nobody knew where they were. And they took their children and either gave them to grandmas or actually gave them to their own military family, the babies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many children who didn't know that until much later.
Well, in fact, the movie is very close to the director's life. This is an autobiographical approach. In his real life, and in the movie, they only talk about Cuba and Brazil, but in real life, he was 4 when the parents decided to leave the country because they were afraid for their life. So they went into exile into a couple of years in Cuba. They also spent some time in Mexico and some time in Brazil. So obviously this child also, he grew with different accents, which is something that also comes through the movie in a funny, humorous way. And then they come back, they came back in 1979, and within a year of being back in Argentina, his mother disappeared. So she was never found. He was, in the movie, he has a little
baby sister.
In his real life, it was a boy. They were 2 brothers. He, just like it happened in the movie, he was left. Someone brought him to his grandmother, and his brother, who was younger, was given away, and they didn't know anything about him. So then we know that the grandmothers of these babies started very shortly the movement of Las Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, and in search for those babies who nobody knew where they were. And so in real life, then the director found his brother in 1984, and that's when his brother also found out his true identity. And this in the movie is very subtle. So if you're not really paying close attention, you probably miss that this little baby is taken away somewhere. But toward the end of the movie, when he's being dropped at his grandmother, he's asking the guy who's dropping him, where's my baby sister? Where's my baby sister? And the guy, of course, doesn't answer at all. There's no, and that's kind of a metaphor for, because you see one of those last scenes is the grandmother receiving this young child. Mm-hmm. Maybe the director is not mentioning about the Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, but it's kind of leaving you there at that moment. So I don't know if Mark wants to
I'm curious
on that.
About the end of this period. We talk about it coming to a conclusion of sorts in 1983. Dr. Polizzi, if you could talk about how there was some sort of resolution and transition into a more stable society.
Well, there's a couple of things. So it did move into a more stable democratic transition. So that was the last military junta within the country. And it's part of a larger wave within the region of countries beginning this democratization process. But of course, with things like this, and because these were forced disappearances, they're still trying to discover what happened to many of these people. So very shortly after the new election of a newly democratic government in 1983, they started a National Truth Commission to try to discover what ultimately happened during this time, the human rights violations, in particular these forced disappearances. But of course, because so many of the bodies were dropped at sea, they can never be found again.
Hmm.
And then in other cases, people were placed into mass graves. And still, even more recently, they will dig up these mass graves and try to run DNA analysis to discover the identities of some of these bodies. But it's part of the issue of these transitions when we talk about these massive human rights violations. The stability for some families never fully comes, and it lasts for generations and generations of these scars. And what is important about films like this is telling it from more of the perspective of some of these victims and showing the long-lasting consequences of these human rights violations. In other cases, as mentioned, the Madres and then the Abuelas, because of their movement, they were able to create a national DNA database that has then been used to test some of these bodies later on, or you know, some of these children that were placed in these military households. A lot of times it would be up to those parents, those new parents, to fess up later on that this wasn't their legitimate child before these tests could go, because an infant wouldn't have known necessarily that they were taken from, you know, their biological parents and placed in these other households.
What kind of scar does that leave on a country? I mean, there is certainly this movement is obviously a direct consequence, but I mean, what does that do to a guy on the street in Buenos Aires and his attitude towards his government and to the establishment, for lack of a better word? I mean, does this, is there any kind of sense of distrust or skepticism from the individual to the government, a government that's capable in an earlier permutation of doing something like this?
Yeah, it creates a lot of hostility and a lack of trust with government institutions. And there's been a lot of efforts in more recent years to try to address some of these consequences. So the National Truth Commission started this longer process where many years later, people were tried in court for these different human rights abuses, and people were placed in jail. But for many others, those are never known. So there's been larger monuments and museums constructed to memorialize the victims of this. So there's a mass wall with the names of people that were disappeared. I mean, there was around 30,000 people. So it's a lot, and it's something where most families might not ever know what ultimately happened.
Do any of you think the Truth Commission has been effective in that, in bringing a resolution and any measure of closure to this period?
To some extent, because for many years it was a period of complete denial. It's not until very late, like, you know, 2000, really, when people are saying, well, yes, this really happened. I mean, I think unless you were one of those families who lost someone and it touches you very closely, for the rest of the society, it was decades of pretty much denial of the atrocities that happened. I mean, we knew some things happened, but not to this extent. I mean, I am talking about 30,000 people, not a handful of people. So
could it be that most families in Argentina were touched and knew about this? Or could it be that some could have just never been, aware or...
It could have been, because, like, again, if you were not touched directly, it was very hard to accept that this was going on almost in a regular basis. For example, the military used to do raids in the houses. So I remember I was a child then. So I remember they would come to your house, knock the door, and say, we need to search a house. They were searching for guns and things like that. So this was something. So it didn't happen, like, I remember only once through the period. But so unless you were in that neighborhood where they decided to do a raid, maybe you didn't notice that this was going on in a very intensive way. Also, I have a teacher, and she had it, because most of the people that disappeared were young, 20s, 30s, people that were studying at the universities. Usually, if you were studying history, political science, things where you are thinking, those were the target. So she had a son who was at the university, so she was telling us the story of his son that has been missing. But we were young, and she's telling us a story, and, I mean, you have a sense that it's strange how he could be missing. She couldn't talk much because she could also have been in danger. So I have, an idea, yeah, this was going on. But unless someone told you stories like that that affected them, I think a lot of people were incomplete. This didn't happen.
Well, we can make a lot of comparisons through history and the world of situations like this. I mean, it starts with the Jewish hunt in World War II in Europe, and then subsequent Nuremberg trials. Then you go to Rwanda and the genocide, where today, and like in Cambodia, the Pol Pot regime, where systematic killings and, you know, where, you know, basically it was a genocide. And today, it's not that long ago, in Kosovo, same thing. Mm-hmm. And today, people have to now live in a sort of democracy, side by side, the victims and their torturers.
Right.
How do you deal with that?